The White Network presents The Heretic's Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm glad to have you joining me on another cold day and now night of December 9th, 2013. I'm assuming it's cold where you are also, since it's pretty cold all over the United States right now. I don't know about Europe, but I don't think too many people from there are listening to me right at the moment. It's nighttime. It's sleeping time. But Florida has stayed warm. That's about it. I'm returning to the Holocaust theme tonight, and this is going to be my major preoccupation for a while, especially on this Monday program, The Heretics Hour. I want to take this opportunity to thank some of the listeners for their contributions that they've made, and I'm still there. I'm looking at the sound. Okay. They are, this time, I want to thank Bert, Rusty, Dimitar, William, and Stephen. And of those, Bert, Dimitar, and William are pretty much monthly contributors. And that's really nice when people decide to do that, and you can pretty much, you can kind of count on it, but it's nice to see them come through every month. And then Rusty was a very generous contributor, and Stephen was a first-time contributor, and he was also quite generous, and we welcome Stephen to listening to the White Network. And I have an email from Stephen. And he sent, and I think I'm going to read it. He said, I'm a listener to your shows on the White Network. I heard about the network from an interview you had with Deanna Spingola on RBN. I've been listening to the archives from the first show, and I'm now in July 2013 for your program. I'd like to thank you for the excellent programming. I listen to your show at work, and it gets me through the day. I especially liked your programs in May of 2013. That was a stellar month with lots of great guests. That month that I had various white nationalist guests that were kind of from the past a little bit, you know, that knew about the older days, the old times. Not that far along, not that far because they're still around, but, you know, that a lot of people are very interested in. And Brad's Love was, I think, right at the beginning. He wasn't one of those, but he is a good speaker and a good guest. And that was when we were celebrating our first year anniversary. So I did that. So Stephen says, Brad Love is very good at speaking. I can see why the Canadian government fears him. And sincerely, and he is in Canada, so he would like Brad Love. There you go. Appreciate hearing from people like that, and I've been getting a lot of really good emails and, exceptionally good. And also, I want to tell you that, in November, this past November, CarolynYeager.net website did exceptionally well as far as visitors go. In fact, it even beat out May as the highest visitor count. And May is probably generally as I see the cycle goes, it builds up, and May is the top month. And then it varies maybe from year to year, but May usually beats out everything else. And so far this year, May had the highest visitor count. But I was just amazed to see November go a little bit above that. And December is starting out real well too. And so, I really think this is because more people and new people are discovering this website, mostly by accident or word of mouth. Expect that when the third anniversary rolls around in September, talking about the CarolynYeager.net anniversary, which is September is quite a ways away yet, the visitor count will be significantly higher than it was the year before, and it was at last September, I think I figured out it was about 30-35% higher than the year before that. So, you know, that's good increase. And I don't do any advertising. I don't do anything to try to bring more traffic to my site. I get emails from companies that do that thing and promise, hey, we can really increase your visibility and people coming. But I think, well, what is the point of trying to get more people coming if they're not going to be, if they're not in tune with what my website is about? So I just let things happen as they will. Now, for your information, I'm at the moment investing more funds into a website for the January 27th United Nations sponsored commemoration for victims of the Holocaust. The website I've talked about in the past. And I don't really want to be any more specific than that right now for security reasons. Although Bradley Smith added at the end of his article in his latest Smith's report, the information on it that I sent out in an email to a number of revisionists. And that's fine. In fact, it's good. But he knows I wanted it to be, you know, advertised, and it certainly seems like it's not too early. But there will be a lot more promotion in January. But right now, I don't want to say anything more until a few more steps are taken, because I don't want the enemy to be poking around looking for, you know, where this thing might be or whatever. So, but I wanted to let you know, those who are most supportive of this effort, and I know there are those who've already indicated that they are, that I welcome donations for this too. You can send them, I'm not asking like, oh, right now you better send me some donations for this, because you haven't even seen anything or gotten the details. So you can certainly wait until you do. But when you do, you can send them to CarolynJaeger.com at PayPal or to the White Network post office box, and mark it as for January 27th. You know, that's all you have to say, and I'll keep an accounting of where what goes where, you know. So I thought I'd also say, you know, I'm really sorry that my PayPal account is under CarolynJaeger.com, because I've been promoting only CarolynJaeger.net for quite a long time now. But actually, I own CarolynJaeger.com too, most of the time, but for a while it wasn't, but it is again, it's directed at CarolynJaeger.net. But I can't change this PayPal account very easily, so it just remains, really without a lot of hassle. And so it just remains as CarolynJaeger.com, and it might be confusing, but not that many people use it, so those who do understand that, and I don't have too much trouble with it, with the discrepancy between the com and net. Now, just I want to make just one quick comment on John Friend's radio broadcast of earlier today. Actually, I had only heard a little bit of it because I was working on this show, but then I went to take a nap, and so I did listen to the rest while I was laying there. But I'm not going to comment on what I heard. I'm just going to say that, and this gets a little old, but I do want to say that not just in this program, but in some of the others, he sounds, and in his blogs, he sounds like, to me, like Elie Wiesel when he insists he never wants anything to do with people who can beat the shite out of him, fact for fact, in a face-to-face encounter, discussion, or debate, and throw him for a loop in addition. And he also acts like Elie Wiesel in the way he keeps himself surrounded by yes-men and supporters at all times. And I am making a prediction, which came to me the other day, as a matter of fact, and it's I'm paraphrasing Adolf Hitler speaking about General Paulus after the surrender at Stalingrad and captured by the Soviets. And, you know, he was even a field marshal at the time, I believe, and he was the leader of all the forces caught in Stalingrad, that terrible tragedy. But Hitler made a comment about that, and I'm paraphrasing it to say, paraphrasing similar to what he said, to say this: it won't be long before we see John Friend, on his own accord, leaving the white nationalist movement for good. Watch for it. Of course, I put movement in quotes because it's really hard to... A lot of sorting out needs to be done, and I'm hoping that at this point some sorting out will be done, and we will get a clearer picture of who belongs where, and to move forward in all of these areas. I'm perfectly happy for John Friend to be working on his conspiracy theories and 9/11 work, and what he terms... Now, I didn't intend to say this. See, I'm adding something here. What he terms media fakery. Well, certainly there's media fakery. There's been media fakery for as long as there's been media, probably. But, of course, it gets more sophisticated all the time. And so it's a good field. And I think, he seems to really like it. And I think that's a great field for him. And I hope he makes, works in that a lot, makes a lot of progress there. Now, I mentioned Smith's report. That's the monthly report that Bradley Smith puts out. And a new one just came out. I just got it, I think, 2 days ago, and I've read it. I looked at it, and I read some of it. Well, I started reading Bradley Smith's article, and I just kept going. He has quite a long one in there, but it's on various things. He kind of does several topics, and he does some items at the end and so on. And the sentence that stood out to me, and I copied down, is: the Holocaust legend today empowers the greatest threat to world peace on the planet. Now, I'd like you to think about that, whether you agree with that. The Holocaust legend empowers the greatest threat to world peace on the planet. Well, I agree with that. Absolutely. Yet Mark Weber decided, as the sole decision maker at IHR, that was not so, that it was Jewish Zionist power, which is conveniently vague. How do you exactly define, or how do you exactly deal with Jewish Zionist power? Because it's everywhere. That power is what rules everything. There's nothing much you can do, that which is what he's decided, which is seems to be the conclusion he's come to. Because how does one go after Jewish Zionist power? Does Mark Weber actually do any battle against Jewish Zionist power via the Institute of Historical Review? Is he on the front line anywhere? In his fundraising letters, and he's been sending them out lately, December is always known to be a good month for fundraising. He always begins with, quote, "In years of hard work, we've established the IHR on the front line in the battle for freedom and historical truth." Well, if you analyze that sentence, years of hard work. So he's referring to the past. The past, when there really was a lot of hard work being done at the IHR. But there isn't anymore, as we know. And then he says, we've established the IHR on the front line. So again, having to refer to the past and the people who did it back then and put the IHR on the front line. But he has retreated, and there's only him. So who's we've, but he is actually referring to the whole history of the IHR when he talks and writes about these things. But he is the one who took it away from that direction. And he is certainly not, he likes to say that they're on the front line. He's on the front line in the battle for freedom and historical truth. Well, even that refers to the past, I guess, because it's no longer on the front line. I'll get back to Mark Weber later in the program, because I first want to address the January 27th commemoration coming up, which is the date of the so-called liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. The media uses this UN-created event to reintroduce and reinforce their Holocaust narrative on a fairly large scale, because they get a lot of, I guess, VIPs, you know, to come to Auschwitz-Birkenau and do some activities and make a lot of speeches. And they can make a lot out of that all over in the whole world media. And then, of course, there's things at the UN, too, and people giving speeches there. So, okay, and I don't have quite have a very good link from that to my next thing I'm going to say. But I'm starting out with something from Bradley Smith's Smith's report in his article that I've already mentioned. And one part of it, a big part of it, is that he was interviewed by a student interviewer about, you know, his revisionism and so on. It sounded kind of like a high school boy. Might have been a college boy, but I got the impression more like high school. But Bradley gives the questions that were asked by this student, probably in writing, and were answered probably in writing, but I don't know for sure. Maybe not. Maybe it was in person to person. But it was a school assignment by this student. And I am using the questions that are there, but I'm not using Bradley's answers. I didn't think that was quite fair. You can go there and read them for yourself. They're quite good, you know. But I've come up with my own answers, or I tried to. I have to admit, this is the last thing I did today, and I didn't really think about it a whole lot. But my point in bringing this up is that on this January 27th website, that this kind of thing should be addressed, because questions, frequently asked questions by Holocaust believers to people who say they don't believe that, all that stuff. And so the first question, and I'm going to have a section on this, and I hope, and the answers will be a lot better, and maybe I will be asking people to send in their own answers to this, you know, before the website goes up and so on. So, and maybe during that time too. But the first question that this student asked, and Bradley said it was probably the most important one, although I think the last question is the most important one, but it was, how did you come to be a revisionist? What made you decide that the majority of society was incorrect in their belief that the Holocaust happened? Was it an event? Did someone you know explain it to you? Well, everybody's answer is going to be personal to that, very personal. So it's all, you know, in my case, I came upon a particular person on the internet while I was very involved in 9/11, but also Holocaust and so on. But I had not yet been able to think that it wasn't, you know, that, as this student says, couldn't believe that the Holocaust didn't happen, you know, nearly the way they said or anything like that. You know, I hadn't decided that yet. So it was a pretty long time ago. And I was kind of new, but, you know, finding my way around quite a bit. And there was this, I was on this site with, that I just thought was great, but there started being some strange things going on. But there was this guy who called himself Neo. Was it Neo? Who's that guy in the movie? The Red Pill, Blue Pill? Neo, I think. He was using that as a screen name. And I thought he was just brilliant, you know. And he said some things that upset, that he was increasingly upsetting the owner of the site, that there was a kind of a forum going on there. And both this other fellow and I were supporting him. We were on the same side, and all three of us got banned all of a sudden. And I was just shocked, you know. I'd never been banned before. And I felt so guilty. I thought, God, what did I do? You know, anyway, somehow we found each other's email addresses. And afterwards we were able to talk together. And, we got to know each other, and I became very good friends with this, man. His name is Martin, his real name. And, I was disappointed that his name wasn't really Neil at that time. And, you know, the fellow who owned this site, I just thought he was very smart too. I was very taken in by, he had these big theories. I'm not going to bother to go into this any further, but, he looked like a Jew, and there were some people, I think it was Neo, who was saying, you know, that he was a Jew. I'm not sure now how that went. I've forgotten most of it. And he showed a picture of himself, and I mean, nobody ever looked more Jewish than this guy. And he was Irish, and said, no, he was Irish Catholic, and this is the way Irish Catholics could look, you know. There was all this stuff going on. Anyway, after that, this Martin and I kept communicating, and sometimes Phil, but mostly Martin and I, and he gave me a reading list and everything. He was much more experienced in all this than I was. And he made the statement on that site before we got banned off of it, that Adolf Hitler was the greatest man of the, you know, of whatever, the century or something, and what the Holocaust wasn't whatever, you know. He didn't say he denied it. I don't know what he said, but that was too much. And I was just, I was so impressed. I mean, I thought, how could he say that? How could he be so sure? But eventually I learned the same. And so that's how I became a revisionist. That's not something I would put on that website, let me tell you. I'm only saying it here because that's the best I could think of for that question. Second question, if the Holocaust never happened, then what did happen during World War II and why? Well, you know, my answer to that now is that the Germans under Hitler engaged in self-defense against the Jewish takeover of their country. That's what happened. And that's why it happened. So that's a short answer, but that's a question that they will ask you. Well, if the Holocaust didn't happen the way they say, well, what was happening? What was going on? Third question, how do you answer to all the people who present you with proof, such as photographs, documents, war records, etc.? Well, my answer there is to that questioner, you call it proof. You know, you call it proof. But the photos are mostly composite images made in U.S. or Soviet war propaganda labs. Many of the documents are tampered with. Most are not originals. Some are downright fakes. Those that are legitimate don't usually prove that much. And what do you mean by war records? Anyway, you know, what does war records mean? So, there's of course better answers to these, but this is the kind of things that people say. They just assume that these photographs prove something and that there's documents that prove it. And there's something called war records that prove it. And we have to deal with that somehow. We have to give some pretty good answers that don't make people have to read so long or read so much. And I'm not saying mine are good. I'm just giving you an example here, and that this needs to be worked on. Now, the fourth question asked was, what about survivors? And the student says, there are still people alive today who claim that they survived the Holocaust. What is your opinion of them? Are they just lying, or did something happen to them and they just don't remember, so they're making things up? Well, that last one's pretty good. People have survived. My answer is people have survived many things, not just the Holocaust. But the Holocaust industry has made survivor almost exclusively used for Jews who simply lived through this period. The examples of survivors lying, of people claiming to be survivors when they are not, are cropping up all the time. We can give tons of examples. of this, of these survivors lying. And a lot of revisionist work is made up of discrediting the eyewitnesses, you know, and it's ridiculous the things that they say that were used to prove that terrible brutality was laid down on these people. And then I go on saying something that was unpleasant and demeaning to them, the survivors, happened to them, did happen to them, and when they saw the opportunity to get revenge on anyone in the group that was behind it, that is the, that group is the Germans, they did. Well, I stopped there. Now the fifth question, why are you a revisionist? Now this is the most important one, not the next, there's a sixth one, but I would say this is the most, a pretty important question. Very similar to the first one, which is, how did you come to be a revisionist? There's not a whole lot of difference there. Is it because you want to make sure everyone knows the truth? Yeah. Or is it that you just want to dispel the myth of the Holocaust? Is there perhaps a more personal reason? Or is it just because? Is there a goal to being a revisionist? Are you trying to achieve something? Well, duh. I answered, I'm a revisionist because I want the lies to go away and the truth to prevail. I fear for a future where the true record is totally, or the true historical record, I should say, or the true record even of the Holocaust, is totally obliterated, and it doesn't even exist in anyone's mind because all those people are gone too. I think this is very possible. I don't want my beloved German race to disappear. And nobody wants their race to disappear. But it's the German race that's gonna, that they want to make disappear the most. Sixth and last, is there a unified body of revisionists that agree on the same thing? Or is being a revisionist an individual experience? Is there a generally agreed upon theory about what happened? Well, this one is easy. I answered no, there is disagreement, mainly on the extent of German guilt and or Jewish guilt. Also on number of Jews who died. No one argues about Germans who died unnecessarily. And how and where they died. Most revisionists accept three main pillars of Holocaust, that the three main pillars of the Holocaust are not true. This is commonly, this is what makes somebody a revisionist. One, no order to exterminate the Jews. Two, no homicidal gas chambers. Three, no 6 million deaths. Not even close. Then I go on. Why do Jews continue to insist on these three things? In my opinion, it's so that the Jewish Holocaust will remain the worst genocide in history, and Jews remain the most persecuted people in history who suffered more than anyone else, which helps them in their anti-Semitism, their use of anti-Semitism to get what they want. So if the Jews let up on these things and made it less, they would be too much like other things, other so-called genocides and other, you know, persecutions that other people have experienced. So they need to keep it at this high, extreme level, that there were these incredible gas chambers, homicidal, that put people in, and that there were 6 million of them killed all in a few years there, and that there was that the intention was to exterminate the Jews from the face of the earth. You know, they need to hang on to that stuff. So that is a weakness of theirs. I believe that's a weakness that needs to be exploited, and of course it is being exploited. And so that's, I thought that was worth mentioning tonight. I'm going to go on now to, talk about Mark Weber some more. A person named Heinrich wrote on the White Network comment section, one of mine, I think it was the one that I talked about Mark Weber. And He told me, he says, Carolyn, you got to go and listen to this. Dana on Renegade Broadcasting interviews Mark Weber, and near the end of the interview, a caller asked him if there were any gas chambers, and he says, there were a few in Poland. Then the caller says that the Germans were the good guys and would never throw people in gas chambers, and Weber gets all shook up and doesn't know how to respond. So I did go and listen to that the other day, and I skipped through some of the middle, but I listened to the beginning and the ending. In the middle of it, they started talking about politics and, you know, political things and so on. But Weber does say on there, in answer to a question from this caller that Heinrich is mentioning, if it wasn't for, well, there were a couple callers and they weren't saying too much, but or maybe there were. Anyway, this one caller called in, and and Weber was thinking he was going to be friendly, you know, but he asked a very pointed question about how many Jews were killed, and Weber answered. He says, after he kind of hems and haws a little bit, well, you know, it's hard to answer, but well, okay, over 2 million, but under 6 million. Just imagine the supposedly one of the leading, people still want to think of him as one of the leading revisionists, and currently the leading revisionist in the United States, because he's director of the Institute for Historical Review, and they have no idea what is really going on there and what Weber really thinks. Because he never talks about things like this, but when he's forced into it, he has to come out with his what he's on record for as saying, that over 2 million Jews were killed by the Germans, by the Nazis, however you want to think about it. But it's not 6 million. Well, that's big of him. So what I just ask, what can you make of that? What do you make of that? And he again attributes it to David Irving. Now, you know, he'll say, now, and that's the same as David Irving says, or that's in agreement with what David Irving says. Well, David Irving is not a Holocaust revisionist. David Irving was a good historian, and when he went to testify or something for Ernst Zundel, and, you know, he learned about the Leuchter report, about the blue staining and so on, not being in these so-called gas chambers. And he was so impressed by that, rightfully so, and he changed his mind and he decided he was going to get into this, but he'd never learned enough about it, and he's such an independent kind of a guy. So anyway, he is not a Holocaust revisionist. And Mark Weber, as I already said, is or has a reputation of being, or he used to be, a Holocaust revisionist, but now he has to follow David Irving. Does this make sense? You know, I mean, the one who was and has the supposed know-how and has done all that writing and so on, and he has in the past, now he has to follow David Irving, who doesn't know beans about it really, but he's got his own theories now about what happened in the East, in the Far East, in the Reinhardt camps. And this is what Weber is saying, where these, that at least 1 million of this 2 million he's talking about were killed in these, three Reinhardt, so-called Reinhardt camps and in gas chambers, that they had gas, even though there's not a and most of you know, there's not a shred of evidence that there was anything like that there, except eyewitness talk, and not that many of them either. But you know, they got a group of them who were there and are saying what happened, and they all say it differently, and they all contradict one another. It's just insane. But Weber doesn't pay any attention to that. And well, at one time I called into a show when he was on Deanna Spingola's show, and I thought that was in 2011. Turns out it was in 2010. But I think Seems so long ago. And I was able to, and he was saying that then, and I told him about the book Sobibor by Matonio Graf and Cuse, that had just recently come out. And he said, and what it said, and he said, oh, I'm not familiar with that book. Well, it didn't just come out the day before, you know, I mean, it had been out a little while, and I had done a program on it. And I got a lot of help from Jürgen Graf in that he actually sent me a summary he wrote up, so I wouldn't get it wrong, I'm sure. And Mark Weber said, I'm not familiar with that book. He said, no, I don't know if it, I'll have to take a look at that and see what it says. If so, if I see something, I'll change my mind. Well, he never changed his mind, and I don't know if he ever looked at the book. But he definitely was not keeping up with revisionism. So while he was at one time, he is not anymore. He's not interested. He wants to talk about Jewish Zionist power and world current events. He's interested, like so many now, in Israel, the Palestinians, AIPAC, you know, how the Jews are running everything. But what does he do about it? Nothing. I mean, he's not even trying to do anything about it. He just wants to give a little talk now and then, or get on a radio show, or do a podcast or two. And I know he does good podcasts. But he never goes into these controversial issues that would show, that would shock people who were revisionists, and you might say, in today's terminology, Holocaust deniers. He never goes into those topics in his podcasts. And of course, he recorded them. He didn't have any questioners, and he hates taking questions. I talked about him on Renegade Broadcasting. It might have been just last Monday, but when I did that, I think it was. So just a week ago, seems longer ago than that, he was on with Kyle Hunt a few weeks ago, and he got treated very well by a few callers who just, you know, told him what a great guy he was. So he was very happy about that. But on Dana's show, he did get this caller trying to get, and he stayed, that caller stayed on the line and was really trying to push him along, you know, trying to get more answers. And I just want to stick in here too about, I was talking about what Weber is doing for the truth. And I say here, as soon as he becomes director of IHR in 1995, I'm saying he used to be a Holocaust revisionist. And as soon as he became director in 1995, that is the date, that is when I think it is, because he became chief editor of the Journal of the IHR in 1993. And he became director of the IHR in 1995. And it was sometime, I think, in the 2000s where he was really drawing away from wanting to talk about the Holocaust at all, that he allies himself with David Irving. And from then on, and I don't know the exact year or whatever, but he was having David Irving at the Institute building for David Irving doing his book sales and so on, his book tour. And he's used David Irving as his source since then. And you know, I say this is shocking and deplorable. This guy is supposed to be the head of this institution, and he has to say what David Irving says about it. And David Irving has a lot of people really like and respect David Irving. That's fine, but he doesn't, he's never been able to show that what he's been saying for several years now about gas chambers in Sobibor and Belzec and Treblinka is true. He keeps talking about it, and he says this and he says that, but there's no evidence. So it's really shameful for Mark Weber. But on that show with Dana, as that caller was trying to, you know, get answers, Dana jumps in finally, and to protect Mark from the caller, And Dana is speaking a mile a minute and saying that he agrees with Mark that the numbers are not important. We don't need to talk about the numbers. And we, you know, the Holocaust is interesting only in knowing in general, but we don't need to get into all the details. And he doesn't think so. What does Dana know about it? Nothing. So that's the kind of person Mark likes to have show, you know, get on their show, because they don't know anything. And whatever he says, they think it's, you know, oh, he's so smart. So Dana is interfering there, and that makes, you know, I'm very disappointed in these people. It's like the blind leading the blind there when it comes to Holocaust, you know. And why do they even want to talk about it when they don't know enough to talk about it? I've said this before, and I really emphasize that. And my final statement on this is that those who say those who are only deniers of the Holocaust, you know, they say, and I'm using that word denier, and probably a lot of you might think I shouldn't use it, and it's their word, it's Lipstadt's word, you know, those who say, you know, they don't believe in the Holocaust story, how about that? And they think it's a hoax. But if they're not read up in real revisionist findings, and they only know of somebody like Mark Weber, who they can turn to talk to on their show, because he's easily available, if he thinks he's not going to meet up with a hostile audience, or a hostile host like me, then he'll go on. But these people should stay away from doing programs on this topic. And I'm dead serious about this. You know, every show host should not be doing a little bit of everything. In my opinion, it's only my opinion, but I wish people listened to my opinion more than they do, because they should not be doing programs on topics that they don't know enough, don't have enough background on, to question the guest like they should, not just treat them as a guest for, you know, Sunday dinner or something. These white nationalists end up passing on misinformation to a bunch of other people who don't know any better, and they think what they're hearing is good info. And then you have these people writing comments, oh, great show with Mark Weber, oh, he knows so much, a font of knowledge, I always enjoyed listening to his podcast. Well, you know, all of this is not really, really working for the enemy. It really is. It's not helping us move forward in Holocaust revisionism. And the idea that's put forth really is that there's no need to talk about it anymore. There's no need to continue researching and doing records. There are people. And even Ingrid Zundel has said this, and I think she generally would say this to the question. Everything has already been discovered, because for her, once Ernst Zundel stopped, that was the end of it all. You know, we don't need to go any further. It's all been done. It hasn't all been done. There are people, and the very brave Carlo Mattonio is still going into issues and researching, and you know, I never knew that much about him. I didn't tend to want to read his books for some reason. They seemed so dry, and I had others that I liked very much, but they're not all doing as much, and some aren't doing anything now. And Carlo Mattonio is still really plugging away, and he's not too old. You know, the revisionists that really are really effective revisionists are all getting older, or are already have quit doing that. And and I don't really see a new crop coming up. And people like Mark Weber are partly responsible for that. It would be the Institute for Historical Review that should be encouraging and making a place for these for younger revisionists and giving them some kind of an income like they had in the 80s and 90s. And there's plenty, you know, there would be plenty of contributors, of people who would contribute big money if there was something going on there and all that. So there could be a future for new revisionists. But there aren't any, because there's Mark Weber, who has hijacked the IHR and put the brakes on it, put a stop to it, and he's been doing it for years, and it gets, you know, more and more and more, and nobody seems to be willing to see or to say, or, you know, to say, what is this man doing and why is he doing it? This is what disappoints me, that people don't see it, and Holocaust is not something that they're, that they've, it's only been on the periphery of what they're doing for a lot of these young white nationalist activists. And that's all right, because, you know, it's a whole different, it's a whole different ball game than just white nationalism or saving the white race, or, you know, which is all very important. All, it's very important. But they, you know, they all have the right attitude toward the Holocaust, but it's not the top issue. But it could, it still needs to be moving forward. And a lot of people believe that. I know, because I just get, you know, lots of support on this position from people. But we always have to look at something and find out and look at deeply enough and be willing to see where the problem is and do something about it. That's why I was talking on Saturday about this problem of nice, you know, being nice. We're supposed to be nice to everyone. It's not the way to go about it. It's not the way to look at it. Let's see. To go on a little bit more about Weber, you might say, well, why don't you leave Mark Weber alone and do something else? Well, in my opinion, as I've been looking at this for quite some time, I don't think it's possible to start a new thing as long as that institute is still there under Mark Weber. And that institute has been associated with Holocaust revisionism. It was founded for that purpose back in the, you know, in the beginning. And so, It's the simplest thing to, in a sense, force Mark Weber out. And then there has to be, though, of course, some people who will take responsibility and then until a new director is found, or there might be a new board of directors, and make a start. And it's a big job. But it's not as big a job as starting one from scratch, because most revisionists today are older and they're tired and they're not going to do that. So either the whole thing, or either Mark Weber stays in there, or he puts somebody of his own choice in place while he stays there, and, you know, and that he's taken care of while this other person does the same as what he's been doing. And if that's the case, then we just don't have an institute. And just think also in terms of, it's called an institute. What is an, I've mentioned this once before, but really, what is an institute? An institute is a place where a certain kind of work is going on, and research and study and writing and producing reports and so on is going on. And that is not going on. How does putting out a little newsletter that is just made up of headline news and links to the on the internet, you know, and links to these news stories, how does that, that doesn't add up in even this, in any sense. It's hardly even an organization, let alone an institute. So I went to, you know, I'm looking around for information on Mark Weber. Well, I guess I should say right here to tie this up a little bit that my thought is that the first thing that should be done is that those radio hosts who are in alternative truth and sympathetic to Holocaust revisionism should be clued in and should be actually, told in no uncertain terms that they should not be having Mark Weber on their show, and they should be told why. And if they don't get it, if they don't want to get it, then there needs to be, you know, more talk to them, because people should be able to get this. This is not too hard to understand. It's all right there in your face. As an example, I'm going to jump ahead here, I think. Where is that? That quote from the about section on, I don't know where it is, on the IHR website, that says that the IHR is not, doesn't take any position on any historical, it mentioned Holocaust, but it doesn't take any position on the Holocaust. It doesn't take any position, it said, on any historical event. It's only trying to open up free discussion or debate or writing or something of history. Now, what kind of a thing is that? Because in the beginning, the IHR was founded for combating the Holocaust, official Holocaust narrative. I mean, it was right out in the open. That's what they started. That's what they were doing. And now, Mark has changed it to it takes no position, not only on Holocaust, but on anything. Any historical event. That's what historical revisionism is. But it's, oh no, we're just looking, well, they're not even doing that. But he's saying our position here is that we just look at history and try to be open-minded about it. I really think he used that word open-minded in that sentence. I'll find that. I'm sure it's here. I'll just don't want to go looking all over the place. So all right. So okay, I said all this. Now, I was looking for information on Mark Weber on, it's, you know, the same old stuff, not much there. And in this SPLC write-up, the SPLC, of course, has a write-up on him, so I thought, well, I'll read that. And they had some interesting quotes from him. It said, it's under, they do a pretty good job of keeping the facts straight, you know, not there. Their attitude toward it is one thing, but they usually have the history right. They've written me up and did a pretty good job. I mean, as far as keeping to the truth and actually finding out anything they could about me, they weren't wrong. And so did the ADL. So I look at these things to see what, you know, what how they put the what they have there that I might have missed somehow. And in 2001, remember I told you that Mark Weber became director of the IHR in 1995, and then it was in, where is all that part, I wonder? Oh, here it is. Yeah, and it's in this article. Okay, it was in 1993 that with Weber's support, the IHR board ousted Carto. And then, you know, in 1995, Weber became director. And then things deteriorated from then on. But in 2001, he was still saying some pretty good things, because here's a quote from Weber. Around the world, awareness is growing that the Holocaust campaign is a major weapon in the Jewish Zionist arsenal, that it is used to justify otherwise unjustifiable Israeli policies, and as a powerful tool for blackmailing enormous sums of money from Americans and Europeans. And that was in an open letter to 14 Arab intellectuals in 2001. Now, yeah, he has turned to Jewish Zionist power, and he has turned to, you know, making out what Israel is doing. But he's saying some pretty strong things here, that that the Holocaust campaign is a major weapon in the Jewish Zionist arsenal, and that it is used to justify unjustifiable Israeli policies, and as a powerful tool for blackmailing enormous sums of money from Americans and Europeans. I don't have any problem with that. And then in 2002, here's a quote at a speech he gave in Arlington at a institute meeting in Arlington, Virginia. That was one of their last ones, I think. One of them, you know, by then. But he said, the most direct and obvious victims of Jewish Zionist power are, of course, the Palestinians who live under Israel's harsh rule. But as the IHR has made clear for years, in truth, we Americans are also victims through the Jewish Zionist grip on the media and the organized Jewish Zionist corruption of our political system. Okay, because he did point out that we're the victims too. It's not just the Palestinians who are victims, and that they have a grip on our media and on our political system. Well, we're going to our break, and so I'm going to stop right here. I have another question from him, but see, today is Monday, and the music for the break will be swing music from Germany in the 1930s, the Golden Sieben Orchestra, kind of a small orchestra, is this. And when we come back, I am going to take phone calls tonight, at 830-443-4911. Oh, Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager at the Heretics Hour on the White Network on Monday, and it is December 9th, 2013. And the subject is the Holocaust in general and how we need to get going with it better than we've been doing lately. Get behind it, and because there's a lot of weakness there, but it's not going to fall apart on its own. And we need this Institute for Historical Review back into the hands of Holocaust revisionists and back into an active position. And I see Mark Weber as having hijacked it. Mike Piper has a lot of has his ideas, and of course he's been aligned with Willis Carto for many, many years, so he's on Willis's side. But and that's fine. Well, I would be too, but the fact is that I'm not sure what that Mark is an agent or is helping the Jews. Well, he certainly is. So, I'm quite open to that. But I can't follow that whole long thing that Mike goes through. I did back when, but I just don't want to go and try to read it again. I did go and look for it a little while back, but I couldn't find it. It was always just the same first program. He did like four programs on it. See, now he was going to do one program and explain it to us. So I listen, and he's so wordy, and I'm pretty wordy myself, but he didn't get very far into it because he just kept talking about this and that. And so then he did a second program, then he had to do a third and a fourth program before he got the whole story out. And I only could find the first program over and over and over again, and I never found the others. So, but I'm sure I could write to him and he'd tell me, but I don't so much want to go into all that because, in my opinion right now, the fact of Mark Weber's laziness and do-nothingness and how he's brought this institute down in the way he has. And he blames it on the times. He blames it on, that nobody cares anymore and people don't want to read about it and people don't want to read books and people don't want to buy magazines. And that's why he had to close down the magazine, because of the internet. Well, other people put out magazines and you could have an internet magazine. Of course, there is now at Kodo, the journal, Inconvenient History Journal, that comes out quarterly. But it's not quite the same as the Journal of Historical Review used to be. It's not as aggressive at all. It's not as exciting. It's kind of... Some of the articles I like a lot and some I don't. And I don't like some of the writers either. So, but I catch, that people don't like me either. So, there's things for everyone, but it doesn't have the quality that, that I really like and that the JHR used to have. So all of this we can see. So we don't need to say, oh, well, Mark Weber is a Jewish agent and Andrew Allen was his handler and all that. And it's not going to make any difference to people probably anyway. So, what we do know is that, he's brought it, he's really hijacked it and he's just running it for himself. I mean, it's just, it hardly needs to be explained, because if people would just put their attention on there and not say, oh, well, but I've heard him do some podcasts or I've heard him on some, and he explains everything really well and I've learned a lot from him. That's true. That's true. And he's written a lot of those articles, but he features his own stuff now on IHR far more than any other. And he's turned it to his own ideas. Here is that quote that I couldn't find from the about page. It was way at the bottom. I just stuck it down here. And at the website under about, it says, Mark has written about the IHR. Through its media work and broadcast interviews, the IHR regularly reaches many tens of thousands of listeners and viewers in the U.S. and overseas. Now, you know, right away, I noticed that there's no time period there. They reach tens of thousands of listeners and viewers who are looking at the website. Sure, but when? Every year? A year? A month? Or something else? You know, it doesn't say. And I hate things like that. I hate when they want to make statements, but they won't. They don't, they're just kind of open-ended. They don't qualify them properly. We don't know what this tens of thousands of listeners means. Not at all. But the worst one here is that, which someone pointed out to me, I read over that and I didn't see this. I mean, it's kind of hidden. It's not hidden, but it just doesn't stand out. This sentence, it says, the IHR does not deny and, I don't think deny, I've got deny in quotes, but I don't know if it's in quotes there. I'm not sure. It might be. The IHR does not deny the Holocaust. Indeed, the IHR as such has no position on any specific event or chapter of history, except to promote greater awareness and understanding and to encourage more objective investigation. Isn't that a bunch of weak puke there? You know, that's really, you know, and I thought, okay, he puts position in quotes as though there is something questionable about it. Okay, I was thinking I put position in quotes when I wrote it down. But no, it's like that. He puts IHR has no position. He puts a position in quotes as though there's something questionable about having a position. That's how I see it. And position should not be in quotes there. There's no reason for it. It has no position on any specific event. But he writes it this way. And or chapter of history. Can you imagine? You know, we're just here. We don't have any point of view. We don't have any beliefs. Don't come after us, you know. Don't call us Holocaust deniers. Every Holocaust organization, and there's zillions of them, that are pushing the official Holocaust message, you know, there's zillions of them. And they all have a position for the standard Holocaust narrative. That's their position. They're absolutely 100% for it. And the IHR, as I said, was created to confront that narrative and demonstrate where it is wrong. But Mark Weber ran away from that founding purpose and then tried to convince others like Greg Johnson to see it that way too. Well, he didn't take much convincing. You know, I stuck that in there because as you recall, maybe, a couple of years ago when Greg Johnson wrote that article about white nationalism and Holocaust revisionism, and it was so long, and he was arguing that white nationalism doesn't need Holocaust revisionism. Well, you know, the thing is that Mark Weber, he may believe in white nationalism, but he won't say so, and he denies that he's a white nationalist, just like he denies that he's a Holocaust denier. He doesn't have any position on anything, and he doesn't really want to talk about it anymore unless he's forced to. By callers when he goes on a radio interview. But it was Mark Weber, Greg Johnson said in that article that somebody who was an expert in revisionism sat him down one day and explained the whole thing to him. And he didn't know a thing about it, never paid any attention, didn't care. And he got everything, that's why I wrote that article, everything Greg Johnson knows about Holocaust is... It came from Mark Weber, and he didn't name Mark Weber, but I figured out right away that he meant Mark Weber, and I was the first one I think to say that. At least I didn't see anybody else saying it, that all Greg Johnson's views were directly the same as Weber's and that he's the one that told him that. So he's even spreading it around to other people as much as he can that Holocaust revisionism is, as he put it in that article in 2009, is more a hindrance than a help. And that was exactly the position that Greg Johnson took in that article that on the Occidental Observer that got, you know, almost 800 comments before they closed the comments. It was quite the place. Everybody was going there, reading and writing. So I'm going to go through this, and I invite people to call if anybody wants to comment or have anything to add to what I've been talking about so far. Again, the number is, you know, you have to dial that 1 and then 830-443-4911. But I will now, I want to go through some of the things in this SPLC article because it's interesting. You know, I think we need a clear picture of Mark Weber. It's so easy. He's so, he is good at making people think he's just the nicest guy and you don't want to be mean to him. Remember that thing about nice. He's very nice. He's very polite and gentlemanly on the programs and he sounds good. He doesn't sound like he's on fire or anything. You know, he doesn't sound exciting, but he sounds reassuring, you know, that he's got it all under control or something. So it says, this is this last quote. I had given you before the break something he said in 2001 and then something he said in 2002 in a speech. And I said they were pretty good, you know. The first one was the best, I thought. The second one was good. And then in 2004, he wrote something that, in my opinion, is not so good and showed how he was changing even more. He said, what is happening is a worldwide conflict now, a global conflict that involves all of humanity. Whether you are a conservative or a liberal, whether your primary loyalties are to your religion, to your ethnic group, to your country, to your heritage in whatever form, you will come up inevitably against this great Jewish Zionist power. What we are involved in is a global struggle for the interests of us all and the interests of humanity. You see how he's moved over now to this globalism, and we're working for all of us. We're working for humanity. We're not just working for ourselves. We can't. Because this is a global power, this Jewish Zionist power. Well, I don't see, you know, I agree there's a huge Jewish Zionist power globally. But I don't see if it's so powerful what we're ever going to do about it. And I think that's what Mark Weber has decided, that it's so big, it's so powerful that there's nothing to do about it. And why go around continuing with the Holocaust? Because it just gets you in trouble. And he has all these people attacking, you know, the Holocaust believers attacking the IHR because of the Holocaust. So he got out of it and, you know, to make life easier for himself. I really believe that's what he's all about. And, you know, here he's saying this, he's talking about whites, that we are responsible to this global community now, that whites have to join in this global community in this struggle. And who's going to be carrying the water? Who's going to be doing the heavy lifting? We whites, we're going to do it. So it's like, we can't save just ourselves. That he's rejecting with this kind of talk anything that white nationalists believe, that we want to save white people. We're not out to save the rest of the world. We're only out to save white people. And he's saying something altogether different, that we can't just save ourselves. And therefore, if we can't just save ourselves, but we have to save the whole world, which a lot of these people who are fighting against Israel and so on are trying to do, then we will certainly not save ourselves. We can't possibly save ourselves. And, you know, the brown people might be saved in the end, but we won't. You know, we're going to be sacrificed for the rest. So, in this article for the SPLC, in 1978, it says, when Weber became news editor of National Vanguard. Now, this is how he began. You know, I went over this myself, and I went over it in that article I wrote, The Unforgivable Sins of Mark Weber. But I'm going over it again now because it's instructive, and it's easy to forget it. In 1978, see, that was a long time ago. I don't know. He got out of the Peace Corps. He was born, I thought it was in 1941, but this thing says 1951, and this thing says 1952. So I don't know what that makes him. Let's see, I already figured that out. I figured he was 27 years old. So if after he got a master's degree, and then if he went into something like, I don't know if it was the Peace Corps or something like it, but he was in Africa, you know, helping the Africans. And he said that he grew up in a liberal home, a family in Portland, Oregon. In fact, for those of you who are don't know this yet, his sister married a Jew. And not only did she marry a Jew, they live in Israel. And his sister is 100%. I mean, she's just really pro Israel. I think she may have converted. She probably converted to Judaism. And they live in Israel. And now you can't blame Mark for what his sister does or did, you know. But they grew up in a liberal family in Portland, Oregon. And I don't know if he has any more siblings than that. I haven't heard of any. But So he goes and he's Africa. He's in the Peace Corps. And he's working with his Andrew Allen, according to Mike Piper, and there's all these connections with the CIA, according to Mike Piper. And so Mike Piper thinks that Andrew Allen, who doesn't sound like he has a Jewish name, but he is Jewish, and he's from the West Coast. He's not only Jewish, he's a revisionist. He worked with the revisionists. He supposedly helped the IHR. He stayed, you know, in good standing, I guess, for quite a while, and then he left it. But, you know, he was helpful, as far as I remember now with Mike's writings, he was helpful to Mark Weber in taking over from Willis Carto. He got back involved again, and he donated a lot of money. And so he is a source of money for Mark Weber. Anyway, with those facts known, in 1978, he's 27 years old. He's out of this Peace Corps business. He's in the United States, and he gets involved with the National Alliance, and he becomes news editor of National Vanguard, which is a publication of the National Alliance. And he remained connected to the Alliance for years, even though in 1979, only a year later, he started writing articles for the Spotlight, which was owned by Willis Carto and other Carto publications. So he was working for Willis Carto, writing articles for Willis Carto's publications while he still remained connected with the National Alliance. But the understanding I have is that he spent most of his time writing and working for Carto and not for the National Vanguard. And in the articles that he was writing back then, he referred to the Holocaust Jewish myth makers. This is what the SPLC is saying. He attacked, He attacked the credibility of Anne Frank's diary. You know, I think he's got an article or two on that. He claimed the Allies used torture to extract false stories about extermination camps. And he suggested that the testimony of victims of the Holocaust was unreliable at best. So he was doing all the stuff, you know, all the regular Holocaust revisionist work. He was right in there with them. He agreed with everything. And he was writing some pretty good articles. Others were too. He wasn't necessarily doing the best work, but he was there. And he was getting paid. I mean, he was making a living with that. Willis Carto was running the, they say the spotlight, but Willis Carto was running the IHR and the JHR, and he was a lot of the people there were being paid or reimbursed, you know, for what they did from Willis Carto's. You know, he was they were on his payroll. He was doing it, putting out. He was, you know, it was his, you know, from his funds. And things were going along, and Weber, then 10 years later in 1989, I mean, all this time he was working with them, he wrote in 1989 that the Holocaust hoax is a religion. He called it the Holocaust hoax in 1989. This is what the Anti-Defamation League said, but I'm sure that's right, that's true. And here's a quote from that Weber wrote in that particular article. The rise of religions such as this generally coincides with the decline and fall of nations which tolerate them. Pretty good. And the same year, he said he didn't believe that it was possible for black people to assimilate into American society. Wow, you know? I mean, he would never say that now unless in a kind of a... He would say it differently. This is not a direct quote, so I don't know how he did say it, but according to the Anti-Defamation League, he said that it was not possible. Said this horrible thing that blacks couldn't really assimilate into American society. And he could have even been talking about this, you know, after the Civil War and stuff like that, because he talks about that too. So you don't know where this, you know, in what context this was. But in 1985, Weber joined the IHR's editorial advisory committee. Let's see, I didn't know that. I didn't had never had that before. So the IHR had an editorial advisory committee, and in 1985 already, Weber was put on that. And in 1992, he took over as editor of the Journal of Historical Review. I have it 1993, but. And he did that until 2000 when he actually that magazine was going downhill. In 1993, back in 1993 again, when he became the main editor of the journal, it says that was when the IHR board ousted Carto as its leader. And it says, with Weber's support, accusing Carto of interfering in editorial decisions. Now, that was, Weber had just come into his own here. He had just become editor of the journal. So he was an influential person there. And he was a big part of this effort. But a lot of them there, they agreed with this. And they accused him of interfering in editorial decisions. Well, they didn't want him to have any say in in what went in the magazine, obviously. And the next May, in that year, I guess, I don't know, it says the next May, either of 93 or 94 then, Carto and his wife tried to retake IHR by occupying its California offices. A situation that led to fistfights and ultimately Carto being forcibly removed from the building. That must have been humiliating. At around the same time, which he considered that place his, and he had built it up, and now they were, you know, it was like a mutiny kind of, you know, but they felt justified. At around the same time, Carto has the kind of personality. He's a very get-things-done person. He deserves a lot of respect, but, you know, as Mike Piper has said many times, people get really mad at him and people hate him and they hate the way he does things. And so he's not that good in people relations, you know. And so that's what was going on here. And then comes up around the same time, that is in around May of when after he got kicked out, after they forcibly removed him from the office, another dispute between IHR and Carto broke out, with IHR leaders accusing Carto of diverting some $10 million that was allegedly left to IHR's parent company, the Legion for the Survival of Freedom. So that's that big bequest that was left that in that woman's will, that all of a sudden everybody got, you know, huge dollar signs in their mind and thinking what could be done with it. And I'm sure some of those revisionists were seriously thinking about how much that could help the Institute and how much they could promote revisionism with that money. They weren't thinking about their, you know, personally getting hold of it. But I think Mark Weber was thinking about that, since he was now in a pretty, in a more of a leadership position. And it says, in this article, during the decade of complex litigation that followed, Carto's Spotlight, Willis Carto's Spotlight magazine, characterized Weber as a rat, a cockroach, and a devil. But in the end, Weber's side basically won. So they had this litigation going on for a while, and boy, did they hate each other, and Carto was calling Weber in particular, all these kind of names, and hated the heck out of him. And since then, Mike Piper does too, you know, and he tries to bring this story out and tries to get it going, but people are interested in it, but, you know, nobody does anything, and it's really hard to know what to do, because who would, if you even, you know, if you're even able to force him to resign, who's going to take his place? You've got to have something, you know, somebody who can do it, and so it doesn't even get worse than it is now. I mean, you know, and it would take more than one person. I mean, it's of course, it takes one energetic person who's willing to really work at it, but it takes more people to support it and so on. And I know that's possible, but it has to be seen. It has to kind of get, people have to get kind of geared up to it. So they do say here that the IHR failed to maintain regular publication of the journal, and now they're calling it a bi-monthly. That was at the end. He turned it into a bi-monthly, and the size of it went down. That was just in the very end. The size of it went down to like 12 or 20 pages per issue, or 25 sometimes. I mean, they were very small, but I don't know why it came out that often. It doesn't make any sense. But this is when Weber was in charge. He kept changing it. It was between April 96 and May 97, one whole year that no issues were published. Well, that was after the lawsuit and everything, and then things were in disarray because of all the stress and strain that caused. And Weber was unable to hold any conferences between 1994 and 2000, 6 years while he was in charge. You know, they had started these annual conferences, and a lot of good people came, and they lasted for a few days, and important speakers, you know, in the revisionist world, and historians and so on were there. This was a big, one of the main things besides the magazine that the Institute did. But for 6 years, between 94 and 2000, there weren't any. And then in 2000, it says they managed to put on a major conference with David Irving in attendance. Here comes David Irving, saving Mark Weber, I guess, in return for something. And also Ernst Zundel was there in 2000, and other notable Holocaust deniers were in attendance. Anyway, by 2003, that's when the publishing of the Journal of Historical Review actually stopped altogether. The last few years were pretty sad. And it limited its conferences to mostly small one-day affairs with speeches by Weber or other IHR staffers. So this is how Weber dealt with all the differences of opinion between everybody, and the strife and the stress and the anger and so on that happened. He just shrunk everything down. He just didn't do anything. This started in 2003. No more journal and no more conferences. He just put on these little small affairs with speeches by him and other people on the staff. And that's what he does now. I don't think they're not even one day affairs. They're just, meetings of a couple hours in length at his little office there. And, he talks and he finds somebody or others to show up and, talk. And there's not very many people there. He builds it up and says, oh, we had a good attendance and liveliness and so on. And as Rodney Martin, revealed back when he was still before he got so friendly with Weber again, that, they had always had alcohol there. I guess alcohol wasn't so much of a big cost for getting some people to come there, and that he thought there was too much drinking going on at these things, and that's why people went. So it's very sad. And more recently, it says here, Weber has sought publicity on James Edwards' talk show, extremist radio talk show, and they run ads on the cesspool. Well, that was back when. I said, now there's somebody who would have Weber on even now and does every so often. James Edwards, he's very mild. They call him extremist. Sure. They allow almost anything. They're very open. I mean, very tolerant at, there. It's because they're very Southern oriented. They worry more about Negroes than they do about Jews. They don't want, actually, they're not, don't even want to be anti-Jew. They'll talk about the Jewish agenda, but they won't restrict Jews at all. And, he goes along with Mark Weber. He's not going to stand up for anything like that. And they don't talk about the Holocaust either. Except, you know, they just have this general, they go along with the general view that, you know, it's not the official, but they won't go out on a limb at all. So, here is this, here is this letter that's been going out from Mark Weber. This is the second time I've seen it so far in December, and it's only December 9th. And as I said, you know, Christmas time is the time when they really try to, get big contributions or as much as they can. It's just like the merchants in the stores. He says, and this is the same one, it just comes out every so often. In years of hard work, I already read that first sentence. In years of hard work, we've established the IHR on the front line in the battle for freedom and historical truth. See, now that's not true. And then it goes on, week after week, we reach activists, students, educators, and opinion makers with solid information and sound perspective on the Zionist push for war, American history, the ongoing turmoil in the Middle East, World War II, the Israel-Palestine conflict, Third Reich Germany, Soviet communism, Holocaust propaganda, the Jewish Zionist grip on our culture and political life, and much more. So, you know, all this is what they cover, and, that's all he can say about it. He says, what we accomplish, listen to this, what we accomplish through meetings, broadcasts, videos, lectures, interviews, online outreach, mailings, books, booklets, discs, and flyers depends on backing from readers like you. You know, all these things have been done at one time or another, but they're not regularly done for sure. And at this, you know, at this point, he just goes on a radio interview rarely. And so then he goes on, right now, we need your support to pay for rent, printing, postage, and other pressing expenses. Well, as their rent is pretty not that high, and they don't print much, and they don't mail. What do they mail? Everything is email. They probably mail out things to their elite mailing list of people who actually donate to them, actually give money, or who have been at events there, which is all Californians, you know, local people that go there. And so how much is that required? Because he doesn't mention it for salaries, his. And he says, if you appreciate our work, please donate and let others know about the IHR. Faithfully yours, Mark Weber. And he gives his address, but he doesn't give a phone number because he doesn't want people to call. I don't blame him, but, you know, he just gives a P.O. box so people can send a check or a money order or whatever. And, of course, he doesn't give his PayPal address here, but you can see it on the site. So now, that's all I have on Mark Weber. I'm trying to think if I have any ways that I want to pull this together a little bit. Because I've already said it, and I don't want to keep repeating myself. I'm going to try to set up some kind of panel or group shows with more than just one other person, at least two others, and maybe three. If I can, you know, if these people, if people who want to talk about this, and, you know, it's hard to get some people who like the idea to talk or get on a radio program, and then there's some people who would get on, but they don't know. Well, I guess we could talk about it with anybody, even people who think differently. But I definitely think that the first step, a good first step, is to really go after the radio hosts who have Mark Weber on. And I guess if I've got listeners who are still listening to this, and they must agree with it if they're listening, unless they're Mark Weber's friends or something. But if you agree with it, excuse me, you know, you could play your part. You could write to these people. You know, if I do it, I'm like interfering. I'm like, you know, get out of our face or something. You know, who are you to tell us what to do? But if others do it, people who are listening, because I'm already saying what I think on these programs. So I don't want to be overly overbearing to these other radio hosts. But you could write to them. You could email them. You could talk to them and say, I don't think you should be promoting Mark Weber. What we need to be promoting is that we need to do a better job in this country where we still have freedom of speech. You can't expect, you know, Europeans to do it. And that's another reason why it's such a travesty of what Mark Weber has done to the IHR, because this was the place that we could have something like that. And he had to destroy it. And I, you know, I'm certainly open to the fact that he had that plan in mind from the beginning, but I don't think it can be proved, so I don't see any point in, you know, making it into a conspiracy, you know, and making yourself look foolish or whatever by saying that. So as I already said, it's best to just go by how he at least doesn't care about helping, you know, this idea that he's somehow fighting Jewish Zionist power in the world doesn't hold up, because he's not making any difference whatsoever. He's not making any difference whatsoever in anything. Well, I'll go on to this little story about the film, The Greatest Story Never Told. It's not a story. It's my thoughts, a few thoughts of mine on it, which I have here. And, you know, it's that everybody is promoting this. And I can't, you know, I can't say it's a bad thing or that it's being promoted, because for a lot of people, it's really tells them something. And it could be that a lot of people who don't know about it, don't know what I know, what you know, are learning something from it. And I looked up this Dennis Wise, you know, it kind of bothered me that Wise is very much a Jewish name, but he seems to be an Irishman. unless he's Irish Scott. It sounds kind of Irish. What I could find and read about him and so on, I don't think he's Jewish at all, but it's funny he has that name, Wise. So maybe that's Irish name. I mean, can be. I'm not sure about it, but I read everything I could about it. You know, I've never been able to watch this film. I've started watching it, but I don't like when Adolf Hitler is portrayed by an actor. In every event, in every instance of a film or video or whatever, where I've seen that, and some of them are anti-Hitler, you know, where they show Hitler as a bumbling, horrible imbecile, and this one is not. It's I guess because that's what everyone says, but I don't have the time to watch a lot of video stuff that I don't need to learn, like some of the later parts of it that go into history of this and that. So that's not new to me. So I don't want to spend the time, but I would watch it if, just to see what it was. But I've started out a couple times at the beginning, forgetting that I had already seen it. And I was so turned off by this, actor that plays the young Hitler, and he looks like this weak little creepy thing, and they portray him as a starving and in Vienna, and he looks awful, and even when Hitler was in Vienna and poor and working, he still looked like the person that he looked like later. He didn't look like some little skinny wimp. Then the other part that you get to in that first portion is Hitler giving his first speech at the German Workers' Party that he went and attended, and then actually he got up and made some comments to the speaker that was there, and his comments, and I guess he continued for a while, you know, back and forth. People were so taken by what he was saying. He was so impressive that they were all listening to him. And then he got an invitation the next day or so from the head of that to come and join. They wanted him to join. So he decided, well, this was maybe the way he was going to go about starting his political career. So he made the decision, that it wasn't an easy decision, to join and start with them. With that party, and there were just a few members, and right away he just kind of moved up to being, they didn't make him the leader right away, but it didn't take too long, because he just was so much more capable than and had the best ideas and so on than anybody else, and he made it grow. So anyway, they have in this film this Hitler giving. But he's like giving a speech, so maybe it's his first speech to as a member of the German Workers' Party or something. But I just hate it. He's the same character, you know. He doesn't look or act like Hitler, and he's so overly dramatic. I mean, they say, oh, Hitler was so dramatic when he spoke. I'm sure not like that. Not, waving his arms around and, that's exaggerated, and it really makes him look creepy. How people can watch that and think, oh, I just got a new image of Adolf Hitler, and much more positive. Well, I don't like it. That's not how I would picture. I'm sure he didn't look anything like that. And making very strange grimaces and expressions on his face. So I just don't like when Hitler is portrayed by an actor. I think it's a big mistake. You can't. And then in acting, when movies are made of things, and if we just even think of Hollywood movies or whatever, but that's okay. I mean, if they make a movie on a historical subject with historical characters in it, and these characters are played by actors and actresses, And if the movie is a big hit, then from then on, the movie is more real, you know, and we see this person as that actor or actress, you know. I can't think of a big historical drama. All I can think of is Gone with the Wind, which is not a real history. It's a novel. But, you know, forever, if you think of Rhett Butler, you're going to see Clark Gable. If you think of Scarlett, you're going to see that, I can't think of her name now, naturally, but that British actress. You think that's how they looked. And the same, you know, goes with all this stuff. I mean, with all these things. I mean, that becomes more real. And I hate to think that people would, this movie's not that well known, but, you know, I wouldn't want people to see Hitler as that in the guy, you know, as the way that actor looked or put him in his place. That's kind of disgusting to me. And that's why I don't think that he should ever be portrayed by an actor. And it's why I don't like films like this. There must be another way to do it than to do this. And of course I like to read, and I think if you read something in the descriptions, you create your own image, and that's better than the image that's created for you by people who make films and put these, you know, real characters are played by actors. So this is okay. I read that short interview that somebody called 12B has a website. The website is 12bytes.org. 12bytes.org. And he did this interview with the Dennis Wise, the creator of this film, The Greatest Story Never Told. And some of you have probably already read it. But there are a couple of parts that I picked out of there. It really did not. Just that the 12 Bytes interviewer asked Dennis Wise if he saw himself as being anti-Semitic or racist. And Dennis says, "I am neither a racist nor anti-Semitic." But, you know, if he said he was a racist and anti-Semitic, well, that would be very bad for his film. And he's hoping to reach people who haven't been reached yet, naturally, with this film. Reach people who would have a negative view of Hitler will change their mind. So naturally, he wouldn't say, even if he was. But so that's all right. I mean, that's to be expected. But he does go on to say, there were many non-whites of different cultures and creed who fought for Germany in World War II, even Jews, and they were not segregated like the black Americans in the U.S. Army. Well, there we go again, you know, pushing this thing about non-whites of all different cultures and religions who fought for Germany in World War II. Yes, they did, but that doesn't mean that Germany was going to be integrated with any of these people. That doesn't, you know, and this implies that, oh, they were welcome, you know, they would have been welcome and so on, which just isn't the case. And so I don't like when this same old thing comes up. This is Veronica Kuzniar Clark. I was surprised and actually pleased that she came on and made some comments at the White Network for Saturday's. Was it Saturday? Or was it the Monday show? I got a little bit of information out of her. I'm going to continue with this. I'm not going to, I might talk about her before the show's over. I've got 10 minutes yet, or not even that. So, but, you know, that, did I read this part that Jesse Owens, he said the U.S. government was truly racist, which used the likes of Jesse Owens in their propaganda against the Third Reich, Well, they did, yeah. They tried to say that Jesse Owens was snubbed and he was this and that, and none of that's true. The Germans, and under Hitler, very much so, they were very gracious to guests of any kind, you know, whatever race they were or whatever, you know, or Muslims and so on. And they treated everybody very respectfully, but they didn't expect anybody to stay there and live there and start, you know, Hitler, you know, they were very much against these blacks that were in the, well, see, I can't think of the name of that place that was French. It's gone back and forth between France and Germany. When the Algerian and French, black French soldiers were there, they were mixing with the German, with the women there, and some of them, sometimes it was rape, but, and he was totally opposed to that. And they, there was, that was before he was chancellor, but, you know, they, that was always a real sore spot for the National Socialists. Then he says, I don't know if this is important. That's okay. He's trying to do a good thing with this film, no doubt about it. And then 12B asks him, 12 Bytes asks him, what message might you have for the white supremacist neo-Nazi skinheads of the world? See, now he doesn't like these people. He doesn't like white supremacists. He doesn't like skinheads. He doesn't like neo-Nazis. And Dennis says simply that their view of Hitler is wrong. The Hitler they admire never existed. He would never have been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Well, that doesn't upset me, but I don't like it, because who says that these people are, who says that, you know, who these people are that they call white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and skinheads, and so on? And who says who says what their view of Hitler is? Who says that they don't, who says that they think that Hitler was, looked like them, or, you know, Hitler didn't have any tattoos, everybody knows that. Hitler didn't shave his head, everybody knows that. Hitler never talked about white supremacism. He did talk about German superiority. Okay, and he did believe that whites needed to rule the world and not colored people, but he believed that colored people, even lightly colored people, should be able to be in charge of their own territories and historical national boundaries and so on, for sure. And they were, you know, he dealt with them. I mean, it's the way this stuff is put, like it's either, you know, far out this way or far out the other way. It's either Hitler, you know, was a Ku Klux Klan type, or Hitler was some kind of multiculturalist. And I resent when things are presented in this way. Well, I should say I resent it. I mean, I just don't agree with it. I think it's too bad. And so there you go with that. Now, I was going to talk about Veronica Kuznier-Clark in the little bit of time I have. Yeah. She calls herself, here's the latest thing to me, for me, she calls herself a paleo liberal, which is actually a kind of a libertarian. And I looked it up, and then she said, no, that wasn't a good place to read about it. She gave another link, and I glanced over that, but I didn't have time to read it. I will try to read that whole page. I guess I will. That's what she considers would be the proper description on this page. I mean, it's just totally not at all like Adolf Hitler at all. And yet she supposedly, you know, is just in love with Adolf Hitler. But she's got this vision of an Adolf Hitler, just like all these people do, that they want to see. You can't just follow, you know, if somebody is just pro-Hitler in general, you can end up with something that you don't expect. And so you have to look deeper and find out just what they mean by Hitler. What is their image of Hitler that they're trying to promote, that they want everybody to like? And it can be very much unlike, for sure, my image of Hitler. And I think the way Hitler really was, as we see through all of his writing, speeches, and so on, there's no evidence that Hitler is the kind of person, and she thinks he evolved into that before the end. But there's no evidence for that whatsoever. But she tries to dredge some up. So, you know, she's another person who, it's too bad. I think it's really too bad, because she can really talk very well about Third Reich issues, and she does a good job on a lot of things. But then in the end, she's got this thing that she's pushing, and she's very liberal and multicultural. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this show is coming to an end. I want to thank you for listening. I'm kind of surprised I have as many listeners as I do, and it's built up, and they've stuck with me here all the way to the end. So I hope that we're going to be able to do something about Mark Weber and the IHR, and I'm going to be putting my attention a lot on Holocaust issues, as I said, and we'll bring back some more of it on this next Monday. So thank you again, and good night for the Heretic Tower.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.